You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we've got a very timely topic for our listeners. I know that I've had a lot of authors on over the years since the 2016 election who've been looking at rural voters, and the crucial role they played in the election of Donald Trump, and especially right here in the Midwest region. And I've got some authors back, and I think of all the books written, and I think I've read every one of them, this might be the best. It really, I think, captures what's going on in rural America, and the authors have data to back it up. And you know the most important part that makes this unique? They're both from a rural area, and I think that adds a lot of authenticity to what they claim in this book. So the book is called The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. And I'm very happy to have on the authors, Nicholas Jacobs and Daniel Shea. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, great. Thanks.
I think we'll just start. I thought it was interesting reading through this, and the historical part's just outstanding in its own right. But as you take us through the history of voting in rural America. But when did this really, the rural voter develop the unique identity that separated itself that you talk about here? What happened and when?
Right. So we've always had rural voters. We've had many more rural voters across many different election cycles than urban voters. Right? Important to recognize that it's not until 1920 until a majority of Americans actually live in an urban area. But although we've always had rural voters, we have not had the rural-urban divide that Dan and I measure. We have not had a rural constituency at a national level vote the way it votes now. By going back through time, Dan and I, the book opens up with this historical overview and an attempt to measure the rural vote going all the way back into the early 1800s. You know, Dan and I pinpoint this development as occurring or beginning in 1980. It's one of the many figures in the book. To be honest, I've lost count, but it's clear. Right. There's an inflection point in the trend. Rural voters were up for grabs throughout the 20th century. Sometimes they'd go for the Democrats, sometimes they wouldn't. But starting in 1980, and in every presidential election since 1980, more and more rural voters, compared to the election prior, turn out and vote Republican. So that by the time you get to the 2016 election, by the time you get to Donald Trump trying to win re-election in 2020, you know, no candidate has ever done better in the history of America with rural voters than Donald Trump. So we circle in on the 1980s first, just as an empirical fact, right? This isn't our hunch. It's not our inclination. It's one that's driven by the actual data on what rural voters are doing at the ballot box. And we think about first what's going on within rural communities in the 1980s and in the immediate, you know, 10, 20 years prior to that, as a way of understanding up, let's say the bottom up pressures. You know, how is the rural economy changing? Well, in most of rural America, right, we are, and by 1980, you're sort of at the peak moment of agricultural consolidation, increased dependency on just a few mill towns, right? But the overall amount of economic opportunity, you know, when viewed from the bottom up, is on the decline. I'll turn it over to Dan to talk about the top-down story we also identify.
Yeah, let me add to that. As with a lot of trends in American politics, they begin at the presidential level, and we see that in 1980. But Nick and I are careful to look not just at presidential voting, but voting for House and for Senate and state legislatures. The transformation of state legislatures, that it's just really something, even honestly, even more dramatic on one level than the presidential voting. So back to that inflection point, what we see is that there are these real world changes that are happening to rural Americans. Their life is changing. Decline of manufacturing, particularly after NAFTA. We spend time talking about the NAFTA ghost town, which is, you know, when that mill closes, when the factory shuts down, the Maytag factory shuts down in Newton, Iowa, that town is gutted, right? And I'm sure many of your listeners know that. But on top of that, there are savvy GOP operatives, Republican operatives, anxious to come into these communities and tell these voters that the Democrats don't care about you, that we care about you. You're the last residents of real America. So this real America, the Democrats don't care narrative takes hold. Ronald Reagan is pretty good at it. It adds momentum through the 90s. Pat Buchanan is very good by Sarah Palin and beyond. And just recently, I was seeing some new clips of Chuck Grassley and others talking about the rural areas being the last places of real America. So there is this sort of top-down, savvy GOP operative piece that is merged, as Nick said, with these real-world bottom pressures, these real-world changes.
They had the Maytag closure in Newton, but also one in Galesburg, which is in our listening area as well, which is near where I actually live. And yeah, NAFTA was a bad, dirty word around here for a number of years, and it still is. You do a lot of innovative things in this book on your analysis, but one of them is this rural voter survey, where you test opinions across a broad range of issues. Talk about that a little bit and how that came about, and maybe some of the key findings, what you were looking for there.
So the rural voter survey, just to give you your listeners a big picture sense, right, is over 14,000 respondents, 10,000 of whom come from rural areas. You know, we see polls and surveys all the time, you know, what rural people think, what urban people think. But as most people know, right, these polls or surveys that you often see in the news or get quick little report outs, right? They maybe only draw on 1,000, maybe 1,500 Americans at any one time. And that's generally all you need to get an average picture of what the United States is looking like on a number of issues. The problem is that rural America is small. And when you get, when you do a survey of 1,500 Americans or 1,200 Americans, you're lucky if you even got 200 rural residents in that survey. Again, on average, is sort of just the miracle of statistics and laws of probability, you're getting it right. But what you can't do is you can't use surveys or polls like that to say anything meaningful about really what's on the minds of rural Americans. You know, Dan and I knew that. Dan and I knew we wanted to, you know, draw on the best possible available methodologies to find out what rural Americans were thinking. And so we sort of put our money where our mouth is, and we got thousands of them. What we believe, and nobody's corrected us yet, is the largest single study of rural voters ever conducted. And, you know, I appreciate you pointing out the fact that Dan and I do live the rural-urban divide. We're scholars of rural politics, and we're residents of rural America. And, you know, one thing that even if you do get adequate sample size and pay attention to all the statistics and figure out how to do that, you know, one thing most people don't have is perspective. And the attitudes and the opinions that you get are the attitudes and opinions you ask about. And I think the most, you know, methodology and statistics aside, the most important thing about the rural voter survey is that we asked rural voters what rural voters wanted to tell us about. And that is so exceptionally rare. We asked them about these things such as the community collapse, community solidarity, community pride. We asked them about what they thought their kids' chances and their growing up in their community was going to be like, you know, and wouldn't you know, when you give people a chance to actually vocalize the concerns that are important to them, you get a very different picture than what is often portrayed by people that lack that perspective, in all honesty.
I was going to ask, and I'm going to throw this right into the mix here, because there's another book that's just come out that has rage in the title and talks about rural voters, this rage and the threat to democracy. And I keep hearing this, and I don't want to be too harsh, but I mean, I'm used to reporters from big papers, from big cities, just helicoptering in here and doing a quick story and flying out. And you address this in the book, but do you find this rage that people are talking about here in rural areas in any of your research or lives or anything?
Well, that's a great question. We really appreciate it, because we've been commenting on writing about this new book for a bit. There is, in rural America, a resentment, I would say deep concerns about the future, may even be anger. But there's anger and resentment across America. What makes rural areas different, or the rural voter different, is they think of their political world through a geographic lens, or they think of politics in terms of their community, what we talk about as a shared fate. They're worried not only about their own well-being, about the well-being of others in their community. So books like what you just talked of, The White Rural Rage, what they often do is they simply look at the statistics that spring from the types of surveys that Nick was talking about, the pullout of the 200 voters from a national survey. And they'll say, look, you see, it's higher in rural America. Attitudes, racial resentment's higher in rural America. But what we've done, and Nick has done a great job in this, I don't know if some of your readers tune into the Daily Yonder. He did a great piece that took a look at some of the methodologies of this book. And what he finds is it's not rural residents per se, or it's not being rural that matters, but other issues, right? It is partisanship, that there's a disproportionate number of Republicans in rural communities. There's a disproportionate number of older or white Americans in rural communities. It is those forces that are driving these percentages, not being rural per se, right? So at the end of our book, we throw this all together in this statistical model that controls for these issues. And when we do that, those issues that jump out in this book, The White Rural Rage, they all disappear. They all fade away. They're controlled by other factors. So Nick's the methodologist of the team. I'm going to let him jump in too.
Man, I'm very glad you reminded us before we started recording that we'd be on the radio. So I had to mind my P's and Q's when thinking about this book. I got many things to say. I want to add real quick to what Dan was saying, and just sort of state unequivocally, though, that to the extent that I think this new obsession with rural rage tends to focus on allegedly rural Americans' higher propensities for violence, allegedly rural Americans' willingness to dispense with constitutional norms and belief in, you know, treating the opposition as legitimate, to the extent that White Rural Rage is really an attempt to portray a vast percentage of rural America as drawn to conspiracy theories, that there is no data to support that. One does not even have to do the work of statistical controls to figure out different motivations. It is just patently false that the vast, vast, vast majority of individuals that are flirting with, you know, political violence attitudes or support for violence live outside of rural America, security and extremism experts actually warn us against typecasting violence as something that only takes place in peripheral regions, because it denies actual threats that live throughout the country. Conspiracism isn't heightened. Christian nationalism, whatever that isn't heightened. But it sells books. And that's, I think, the last thing I can really say about it. You know, it's dangerous. I think those types of claims are the real threats to democracy. Dan and I try to understand people's motivations. And there is resentment in many rural communities. I think it is disingenuous to say that this idea of resentment is equivalent to rage. I think it is demeaning. I think it strips people of their intentionality and the reasons they and the stories they have about why they're resentful towards government and towards the Democratic Party. I'm not saying those resentments are always fact-informed or logical or that I even agree with them, but as scholars and as two scholars who are very interested in healing this country's divides, you have to understand those resentments rather than brush them off as sort of knee-jerk rage or, you know, I don't know why they think rural people are just violent rednecks up in the hills.
Well, but, you know, Robin, if you don't mind, I'm going to add something else from our book. We took a look at all these issues, and what's fascinating is on a number of dimensions, rural Americans are no further to the right than are conservatives, Republicans, and other parts of the country. And there's unfortunately racism across this country. You know, but one of the more important parts of the books is that we pull out a particular group of rural residents, a group of Americans who are very attuned to the media, that are spending a lot of time posting online, reading about the news, deeply engaged in the media. And we think this makes up about 10%. And these are what we discovered, the very aggressive, very loud rural voters. We call them the rural rabble-rousers. They are the ones that are painting their barns. They're the ones that are on the street corner. Now that's all fine. It's all free speech and mobilization. That's all great. But that is a very different picture than most rural Americans. And unfortunately, it's a picture that non-rural Americans, city and suburban Americans, often see when they go into rural America. And too often, it's the American, it's the rural voter that is reported on by non-rural media, right? So this group is very different. And unfortunately, they capture a lot of attention. And I think they even drive the narrative of books like this that you're talking about, when in reality, we think about 90%, maybe even a little more, are really more or less like all Americans.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very delighted to have as my guest today the authors of a new book on rural voters, which I think is, I think it's the best out there. And as listeners know, I've read and had guests on most all the authors of these books over the last 6-7 years. They're Nicholas Jacobs and Daniel Shea, and the book is called The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. I'd love to go through all the different issues that you looked at, but I'm just going to ask my question on the survey this way. Was there anything in there that surprised both of you before you did the survey and then coming out? What, if there was, what surprised you the most, let's say?
Let me go real quick. The extent to which rural Americans like where they live and want to be there, right? It's very clear. We asked this one question about, if given a chance, would you leave? And non-rural Americans were twice as likely to say yes if you lived in suburban or urban America. Rural Americans like where they live. They want to stay there. They want to develop and build their community. And they are deeply engaged. So, you know, I had read in prep for this book another book, and I don't want to be critical of this book. A journalist did a book called Alienated America, Tim Carney. And I got the sense from that book that these towns were withering away where people wanted to leave, but just couldn't. That's not at all what we found. I suspect a lot of your listeners are nodding their heads on that.
Dan likes to go first because he takes it.
I love that. I love that one. That's a good one.
I think in the reverse, one thing that it's a shame that it's surprising, but it's good to be candid and to share that it's good to reflect on it, and it's sort of the reverse, like what suburban and urban America was thinking. And you know, we talk a lot of times about rural America as the place where you see the flags flying on the back of pickup trucks or hanging from the barn. You know, I'm just thinking about my commute in this morning, and it's true. But you know, there's patriots everywhere. Like people, Americans love this country. They have disagreements, and sometimes those disagreements are on really important issues. But there are patriots in the middle of New York City, in the middle of San Francisco. This is a religious country, you know, especially when you think about voters and even urban areas. I'll go to the hard case, right? Like your stereotypical image of your urban voter is just as far off as your stereotypical vision of the rural voter, right? There are, you know, evangelical communities, largely racial minorities living in the middle of cities, right? Who are voting with religion at the top of their mind. And so a lot of these, you know, it was surprising, I suppose, to think about how much I knew the real America myth did not apply to, you know, the communities that I call home, the communities that I study. But it was important to see and constantly reflect on the fact that a lot of that real America myth overlooks how real America is in urban and suburban areas too.
Got to ask, why is this important? Why should people care? I mean, we've got this difference, yeah, and it's become wider in the Trump era, and your book shows this. Why is this important, and can we do anything to overcome this if it is so important?
That's a great question. I'm going to do real quick a more sort of pragmatic thing, because I think Nick wants to talk about the sort of more democratic, small d democratic issue. We think it's really important that there be two-party competition across this country. We didn't write this book as a sort of a to-do list for Democrats, a prescription for Democrats, but we're dead fast in our belief that our democracy is well served when there is two-party competition across the country. And in many rural communities, that's not happening. So that's a sort of more pragmatic piece of our system. But I think there's a broader issue too, right, Nick?
So I think this divide is one of the most important issues facing our country, because it ultimately is about how we, as fellow citizens of this country, understand one another. And, you know, I think that's why it is so distressing when we read books that try to portray rural America as so out of touch, right, as this threat to democracy, because I think the real threat to democracy is not seeing the deep bonds and interconnectedness that we share across different community types. You know, rural Americans are different in some wonderful and weird ways. I think there are, you know, different values in these different types of communities, but they're not the political disagreements that get reinforced and elevated through this political divide, through the lack of party competition. And they are not differences that our system cannot accommodate and allow to flourish, right? And when we get to a point where we're not just divided by politics, but literally divided by space, it becomes that much more difficult to see one another as legitimate, as holding ideas that are worthy of holding, as living lives that are worthy of living. And you know, I think this is, I will say, I think this is exceptionally true in how rural people are viewed. It is the case that, you know, rural people travel into urban spaces much more often than urban people travel into rural spaces. And it's so easy to rely on stereotypes as a result for what you think is going on. And it allows at one level, it allows, I think, exploitative figures and politicians to fill the void and not be challenged. But ultimately it comes down to us ourselves, right? You cannot scapegoat Donald Trump. You cannot scapegoat the Democrats. You know, this divide exists because average people, right, hold these grossly distorted images of one another.
I've just got a couple minutes left here, so I hate to do this to you, but a quote from the book, the rural voter is not the Trump voter. I found that a little interesting. Can you, in a couple minutes, try to condense that and explain that to our listeners?
Well, we could go back to that figure that we mentioned at the start of our chat. So this trend begins in 1980. And if we were to project the rural vote in 2016 and 2020, it would have been precisely where Donald Trump was. Now, so it is true, though, that Donald Trump does seem to tap into a sentiment in rural America that is helpful for him, that it really works for his campaign. And I think at the core of it is that rural voters are deeply concerned about a change, about a shift in what's been going on. And they're looking for a disruptor. And I think Donald Trump is that disruptor for many of these rural Americans. They want something different. And they've come to believe, and I don't think it's quite fair, to be honest, that the Democrats don't have their interest in mind. There are much more that Democrats could do. They have, in many communities, turned their back to rural voters. But Donald Trump seems to tap into this concern about something really different as we move ahead.
One minute, please, Nicholas.
Yeah, I would just sort of emphasize that there were two candidates on the ballot in 2016. One of them seemed primed to take that anti-establishment, and the other just seemed so well exceptionally positioned to do awful in rural areas, right? The same name as this person that signed NAFTA, the person that came off as entirely unempathetic to coal miners in West Virginia, who after she lost the election celebrated the fact that she lost in the places moving behind.
Well, that's folks, we've just barely touched the surface of this book. And I really appreciate the time of the authors to come on our show. And maybe we'll come back at some point to kind of see where we're at, maybe after this next election, and talk to these two gentlemen and get their perspective. This book is called The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. Nicholas Jacobs and Daniel Shea, the authors, and they've been my guests today on Heartland Politics. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Rob.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.